The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. The Champions League, Liverpool and Manchester City make it through the group stages. Incident-free games without talking points. Will Klopp and Pep please think of the podcasts that have to feed off their scraps? Crisis in Madrid. Sid joins us to talk Zidane, defeat to Shakhtar and the rest of La Liga. We'll look at Anton Ferdinand's incredibly moving documentary, Football, Racism and Me. We'll go down Admin Alley to discuss the new Champions League plans and the impact of Brexit on the game. There's some love for Nivaldo. Has Barry got a new boiler? And have any of us recorded this in good enough quality for any of you to actually be able to hear it? Hopefully you know that by now already. Your questions have been added. As always, this is the Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Barry Glendenning, hello.
Hello, Max.
Hello, Natasha Henry.
Hey, how are you?
Yeah, jolly good, thank you. Hello, John Bruin.
Good morning, Max. How are you?
Yeah, I'm marvellous. So the second audio-based apology of recent pods. Barry, what did you do last pod?
Well, I didn't do anything wrong. The way you told it on Twitter was that I was some sort of Luddite who had messed up my recording, but I did everything perfectly correctly and my SD card didn't save the file. So I have now got a new SD card at my own expense. I had to queue for at least 45 minutes outside Argos in Atlantic Road, Brixton yesterday in the cold. They are the lengths I will go to keep the people happy.
Now, I pressed the wrong button, so the microphone I'm talking into didn't pick up the sound, but a microphone about 5 yards away did. But someone nicely pointed out that what they really enjoyed was the sound quality on my apology was also bad because I had the phone too close to my mouth, so it popped a whole lot. David says, bring back the echo. Listen, as far as we know, and we've done some tests, this sounds great to us. Hopefully, it sounds great to you. Let's talk then about the English clubs who played last night first. We'll do Liverpool's group first. They beat Ajax 1-0. They win the group. Curtis Jones goal in the second half. I challenged the three of you to come up with one interesting thing to say about both the Liverpool and the Manchester City games. I think this is quite an unfair question to launch on anybody at 7 a.m. John Bruin, something interesting about Liverpool-Ajax.
You saw the way Jurgen Klopp celebrated at the end of this game, the relief on his face because there'd been a victory over, and he'd seen off someone or something that had really caused him problems over the years or in recent weeks, and that was Des Kelly. So, and it's the way he escaped after his 3 minutes with Des. Which were cordial, but not exactly warm. There was no mention of tired muscles, although he was able to say about Andy Robertson getting a knock. But what he was able to do was enthuse about the young players. And at this point, our pronunciation of Irish names runs into problems.
Quive
is what Jurgen Klopp called the young goalkeeper who had a very good game and made a great save towards the end of the match. And then you've Nico Williams and then Curtis Jones who scored the goal. Jurgen Klopp called it one of his favourite nights as Liverpool manager, and you can see why. It was a win through adversity, and he and Des Kelly were able to be polite to each other. So that was a victory. Football was the winner last night.
Owen Hargreaves compared Curtis Jones to Steven Gerrard. This seems the right time to start building someone up to that sort of level. He's a tremendous player, isn't it? Well, look, John, that was interesting. Natasha, to you, something interesting about this game?
I was going to say similar to John in that it gave Liverpool fans a chance to see the happy Jurgen Klopp that they've bought into for a very long time. They're in denial about his kind of passive-aggressive nature that a lot of us have seen in press conferences. Don't get me wrong, I respect him a lot as a manager, but just because you say something with a smile doesn't make it any nicer than what it is to begin with. And I think as Liverpool fans, they love young players coming through. They love to see this talent from the academy. So I think that's the best thing from the Liverpool game moving forward. And again, also, like, let's protect Des Kelly. As a journalist, you know, he got a lot of grief for apparently wording his questions in a way that were antagonistic towards Jurgen at the weekend. I don't buy that. I don't believe that's the case. And, you know, if it makes 2020 easier for a lot of people to believe that Jurgen Klopp is this lovely, nice, friendly guy, then, yeah, I'm happy for that. Let's have a nice December moving forward.
Barry Glendening.
Well, I've worked with Des Kelly a few times, and I think it would be impossible to stay mad at him for long. He's urbane, sophisticated, dishy, smells lovely, and a consummate professional. So I really hope he and Jurgen are able to put Saturday's contretemps behind them. I was impressed with Queevey and Kelleher. Obviously, Jurgen Klopp will be tearing his hair out again and thinking the gods are conspiring against him. Well, the gods, BT Sport, the Premier League and UEFA are conspiring against him because Alisson is now injured. He's done his hammy and, well, it's felt a bit of a twitch and will probably be out for 2 weeks. So Liverpool fans will have been heartened by the assured performance of Queeveen. That's the Irish for Kevin, by the way. So Kevin Kelleher. Queeveen, who was born in Cork and educated by the Presentation Brothers. So you're just a classic Irish man.
Sorry, the Presentation Brothers?
Well, when I grew up, I was educated in up until the age of 12, Presentation Brothers. So they're not quite priests, but they are a religious order.
Right.
You know, kind of like Friar Tuck. He's not a priest. And then after that, I was educated by Cistercian monks. So all that religion may explain why I've turned out to be the twisted, bonkers, slightly unhinged individual that I am. But I think Liverpool fans will... They don't need to worry about Alisson being absent. And weirdly, you know... Jurgen Klopp has been complaining a lot with some justification. I don't think a huge amount about the Liverpool fixture congestion and all the injuries they've had. But seeing Alisson pull out with a hamstring injury or a soft tissue injury, you know, he's not sprinting around the pitch three times a week. He's sort of mooching around his penalty area most of the time and taking the odd kick out. So... that does seem to be just down to bad luck rather than anything else. But good win for Liverpool.
John?
I did a bit of reading around Queeveen Kelleher, and it seems that as a young player over in Ireland, he actually was an outfield player. And this was the thing that... So we probably need to be aware that if he's going to play like that, he might pull his hamstring at a certain point because... is a Liverpool player. But it was interesting that during his date on with Des Kelly, Jurgen Klopp talked about Adrian. He said, you know, he's done a great job for us and kept plenty of clean sheets way back when, but that Kelleher was in the team because of his ability to play with the ball at his feet, which, as we've seen, is not necessarily Adrian's strongest suit. So in Kelleher's favour, as well as making good saves, it appears his ability to play the ball out is going to make him Liverpool's second choice. You would have thought after that performance for the foreseeable future.
Andy Lonergan, who had a spell as Liverpool's third choice keeper, he did an interview with some Liverpool podcast and said that Kelleher is excellent with the ball at his feet. It's like he's a central midfielder. So maybe he played as a central midfielder. I don't know.
Yeah, he did actually, Barry. Yeah, over back in Cork. Yeah.
On this, you know, the kind of mask. I don't know if it's the mask dropping from Klopp or just a sense that he isn't just the loveliest, best thing about football. Just sort of this week. Do you get a sense that in a way that, I don't know, some journalists can jump on that and suddenly go, aha, he's not as wonderful as we all thought, and maybe go a bit overboard. Like, to defend Klopp, he's been pretty bloody brilliant for the Premier League.
I mean, I love Klopp as a manager. You know, I think he's been great for the league. I think he's been great for Liverpool. But I do think that this whole tribal mentality that a lot of fans have is that maybe they don't always see what others see in a, they just see the questions or read the answers to what he said. I don't think it's the mask dropping. I just think he's no different from a Ferguson or a Mourinho. I just think, you know, the teeth and the glasses and I love rock music is maybe what's made people, you know, it was made people think that he's a nicer chap. But at the end of the day, he's a world-class manager who wants to win things. You have to have that kind of steel, that kind of angry inner sense in order to be able to do that. You know, as an Arsenal fan, I know what happens when you just start being nice and stop being angry. You know, he has that anger and that's why his team are going out there and getting the results every week. And, you know, that's why they're champions.
We all knew he had a bit of a temper on him. That's no secret. We've always known he has a bit of a temper. And you know, being interviewed 5 minutes after a game when you've thrown away a lead at a game and you think you've been hard done by, you know, of course you're going to be chippy and that should be excused, I think. It's not practical to give managers a 30-minute cooling off period before you interview them. They have to go and do all their media duties immediately after the game, starting with the pitch side reporter and then working their way through the radio or other TV stations, the radio guys, and then finally the newspaper boys. So at that point they've possibly had a bit of a chance to simmer down a bit. Often they haven't, but that's probably the part of the job many of them enjoy least.
I mean, I've watched him on YouTube play Crown Green Bowls with some Scouse pensioners and it made me melt. So I can't really hear anything bad about him. That worked for me. All I have to do is watch him just on the bays, just rolling those little round things so calmly. It was a total delight. Also in that group, Atalanta drew with Midtjylland. Alexander Schultz scored an absolute banger. Anyway, that point gives Atalanta the edge over Ajax. They only need a draw to go through when they meet next week. To Porto, Manchester City then. They both qualify for the next round. Porto's XG was 0.03, which sounds fun. City's was 3.15. Again, Barry, I'll come to you first, as I went to you third, the hardest role for the last one. Something interesting about this football match?
Well, I was unaware that there was a beef between Pep Guardiola and Sergio Conceição, the Porto manager, until I read about Jamie Jackson alluded to it in his match report. And apparently they fell out during the corresponding fixture at the Etihad. And the Porto manager had accused Guardiola of trying to influence referees, and Pep took grave exception to that. But further investigation reveals that the Porto manager is apparently a very difficult man to get on with. And one of his own backroom staff resigned because of the what he called an unbearable working environment. So I thought that was kind of interesting, that it must be fun at Porto training sessions if the role manager is constantly ranting and raving. He appears to have I don't think Des Kelly and he would get on particularly well. But I was also hugely impressed with the Porto keeper, Augustin Marchesin, who I had never heard of before, but he put in a magnificent display of goalkeeping.
John Bruin.
Yeah, I struggled a bit more with this game to find anything interesting. I suppose what you could say is Manchester City continue to have something of a problem in front of goal. You don't get to play Sean Dyche's Burnley every week, as they did at the weekend. Though they probably should have scored in the second half. The goal that was disallowed by Gabriel Jesus, I should say, it was one of those where I watched it and I thought, that's a goal. And I've got to confess this. I watched the goal show, obviously, which is presented by dissident former Football Weekly panelist and presenter. And they seemed at a loss why this goal had been disallowed. But it seemed it was to do with phases of play and offside. And OK, as it stands, it should have been disallowed. The thing that I took from that goal, the disallowed goal, is Phil Foden in joining the celebration. He's got great bandy legs, hasn't he? The way that he sort of bounces around. And I think that's what makes him such a great young player. Remember in the old days, we used to talk about sort of your Scottish playmaker, your... they always had bandy legs, didn't they? Like a street footballer. And that's what he looked like to me. And if you actually watch back the celebration of that, that those bandy legs, the way that he moves them around, are in such a great demonstration of that. So all I can take away from that game is Phil Foden's legs.
So but bandy, not bow. I mean, do they go down straight, or you're not saying bow?
Just well, they're bandy. Sort of bowed and bandy. Yeah. And I think that's why, because he's so comfortable in possession, and I think that's a result of his physiology.
Natasha Henry.
So talking about bandy legs, Pep is bow-legged. I noticed this at Bramall Lane at Sheffield United, random fact. He still dresses well. We still love Pep. This game probably won't go down in the history books. I think probably Rodri is the key thing that I took away from this game, just him being City's or Pep's new go-to guy, if you want to call him that. I think, they're struggling in front of goal, but I think Pep's maybe coming with the mentality that if we can't score, then we just don't need to concede anymore. It wasn't the best game. I only watched the highlights this morning, I can't lie, but I'm guessing I didn't miss that much from what everyone else has said.
Can I just mention Pep Guardiola's jacket? Have you seen this?
Yeah, please do. Please do.
There's some sort of motif on the back, isn't there? And
I just presumed it was the City crest, but I could be mistaken.
But it's Alan Partridge's Castrol GTX jacket, isn't it?
Is it like the T-Birds?
You know when you go to somewhere like TK Maxx and you see like a jacket or something or a shirt and you think, well, that's pretty good for the price, you know, well, that's good. And then you pull it round and you look at the back and it's got something horrific, you know, like like Ohio Motorcycling Club or something like that. That's what that jacket looks like. It looks like he's thought, it looks pretty slick up the front, you know, it's a bit sort of Fergie style or whatever. But no, he's got this nightmare on the back.
Thinking about the Venn diagram, there must be one person who both listens to this podcast and is a member of the Ohio Motorcycle Club. And if you're that person, please get in touch with us. It was a terrible game. Also in that group, Marseille beat Olympiacos 2-1. Their first goals, Marseille's, of this Champions League tournament. Dimitri Payet with two penalties. So well done to them. But, you know, there was no massive point in this game, really. And that'll do for part one. Sid will join us for part two as we talk about Real Madrid's meltdown against Shakhtar Donetsk. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's say hello to Sid Lowe in Spain. Hello, Sid.
Hi, Max. How are you?
Yeah, I'm excellent. Thanks so much. So Shakhtar 2, Real Madrid 0. Duncan Alexander's stat. Zinedine Zidane has lost more games than Steve Bruce this season. Richard Jolly's stat. The last season Real Madrid were not in the Champions League knockout stages was so long ago that Roy Hodgson was in his 40s.
oh, that is cool.
Coutinho and Manuel Solomon with the goal. Solomon's was a great goal. I'm not entirely sure what Varane was doing for the first one. Sid, your thoughts?
Well, first things first, I'm disappointed with that first stat, because what I really want to know, of course, is whether Zidane has as many wins as Sam Allardyce, because that would be the key to fixing Real Madrid's problems, as Sam has said many, many times. My first thoughts, put bluntly, are that Real Madrid aren't very good. And, I mean, obviously, look, they've got a lot of very good players. They have shown on a few occasions this year that when they've really needed to, they've pulled good results out. So, of course, they won the Clásico. They've beaten Inter Milan twice, although I think in the first one of those at Val de Bebas, not in Italy, they were a bit fortunate to win. But they've had a lot of the problems that we saw last night. They've had all season. They're vulnerable at the back. They don't take the chances. They don't really convince. They tail off after the 60th, 70th minute repeatedly. And as I say, the truth is they just don't look very good. Now, I still have a sneaking suspicion, I don't know about you lot, that they'll get through and they may even win the group, because it's a very strange group and it's set up in a way that, that basically anyone can go through and anyone can top the group now. But this, I was about to say this doesn't come as a surprise. Of course it does. You know, I still thought they would go to the Ukraine and win. But it does fit within the pattern of what we've seen so far this season.
Zidane's quotes after the game, I mean, he could have rented them from any manager in the bottom half of the championship. Sort of said, I'm not going to resign. We're always going to have difficult moments. We're on a bad run, but we need to keep going. I have the strength to turn the situation around. I'm going to give everything to do that. So are the players. We played well and deserve more. We just need to lift our heads up and think about the next game. Jeff. Mm. He didn't say Jeff. Yeah.
I would love him to say Jeff at some point. It would be brilliant. I mean, I'm also. I mean, yeah, maybe I'm just showing my age, but saying Jeff. I mean, it used to be Brian, didn't it, or Trevor?
I think it was Brian.
It feels wrong that it's Jeff, doesn't it?
Yeah. Do you think he'll go? I mean, will he go? What do you think?
Well, look. Last night he was asked directly. You know, will you resign? He said no, not at all. There is a huge amount of pressure on him from within the club, which he's well aware of. And I think one of the things you should always remember with Zidane is when he talks about his future or when he's asked about his future, he knows how volatile Real Madrid is. He understands the politics around it very, very well. And last night, El Mundo, whose reporter is very well connected at Real Madrid, particularly directly with the upper echelons of the club, with the president. And El Mundo ran a tweet saying that Real Madrid, Florentino Perez, the president, is contemplating getting rid of Zidane. That tweet was taken down pretty quickly. Now, I don't want to overinterpret something that I don't know for sure, and I don't want to jump the gun, but that smelt to me very much like a president who had a rant about Zidane post-game and then saw this in black and white and thought, whoa, hang on, let's back away from this. But I don't think there's any doubt that he's under pressure. And look, too, at what's coming up. So they play Sevilla at the weekend, and then they play Borussia Mönchengladbach, obviously, in the Champions League next week, with the possibility that they don't even get through. And I think that if he was to lose those two, then he'd be in trouble. The other thing is that you've got to look at this in the context. And Zidane has been on what the Spanish always describe as a match ball three or four times this year. And he keeps saving that match ball and keeps coming through. And it even happened last year. Remember in October of last year, they went away to Istanbul. And had they lost, he genuinely could have been sacked. And he didn't. And he went through and they won the league. And it's happened, obviously, this year on the way into the game in Milan. And so I think that he's kind of permanently on a tightrope. And he's, you know, a club like Real Madrid is always only three or four bad results away from a kind of a mini crisis. And so he's under enormous pressure, partly, of course, because Real Madrid is a club that at some level, at least, always has a mentality that the manager is at least partly expendable, even when it's someone like Zidane, who has obviously far greater protection and credit, to use a horrible Spanish phrase, far greater credit than just about anyone else would have.
You say their squad is good. How good is it? Because you sort of look at the team and you go, yeah, they've got some good players, but just, you know, when you imagine, you look at a Real Madrid lineup and you expect to see these ridiculous names and these amazing players.
Yeah, I think that's a fair question, actually. And it is one that's been posed a little bit because, of course, the renewal of the squad, the bringing younger players through who are really good, has been, I suppose, you could probably call it a partial success, because I think, obviously, there's been moments when Vinicius has played a very important role. Fede Valverde was very important last year. Martin Ødegaard was recalled from a two-year loan at Real Sociedad after just 1 year and hasn't really played a part yet, but I think will be a really good player. Ferland Mendy has played really, really well. But you do look at that squad and still think, well, but it hasn't kind of come all the way. This process hasn't come all the way through yet. And it does feel like there's quite a few older players. And in particular in midfield, where they've tended to be a little bit overrun, all the more so when Casemiro doesn't play, and he didn't play last night. You know, Modric is still brilliant when he's good. And Kroos is a wonderful footballer. But it does feel like there's maybe a slight lack of energy about Real Madrid. Yeah.
I had to vote for my top 40 footballers, you know, for the Guardian's top 100.
Yeah.
And I put Wes Houlihan in, and I was told I wasn't allowed him, so I had to put Modric back in. But that's probably fair.
Max, at this stage, I mean, because I haven't done my vote yet, I'm at the understanding that your player, that you can choose anyone you want. They don't need to be on the long list.
I was told Wes Houlihan was not allowed. I said he's playing well at the moment, but It's been blackballed. Can you believe it?
I think that's appalling.
I think it's outrageous.
You know what? When I submit my list, I'm putting Wes Houlihan in at number one.
I submitted mine yesterday, and it's an annual tradition that I include somebody twice and have one incredibly glaring omission. So I double parked Joshua Kimmich this year by mistake, and I was about to submit it, and then I realised I'd forgotten to include Erling Braut Haaland. So that prompted a major reshuffle.
You see, that's the thing. If you miss one out, if you miss one out, it's a nightmare because you've got to do it in order. So in other words, you miss one out and he's not in the 40 at all. And you go, right, so where am I going to put him? Let's say for argument's sake, Haaland. I don't know where you're putting him. Let's say for argument's sake.
Seventh.
Right, okay. All right, there you go. Seventh. So then everybody else, you've got to go through and change the bloody numbers on all of them. Can't you just write like 6.5, put him in at 6.5 and just let the others be there?
It's interesting doing this list because I wondered where to put Romelu Lukaku because, you know, obviously you say this group is wide open because of Inter's win at Borussia Mönchengladbach. And Lukaku scored twice and is brilliant again. And I've got a question here, which is how many centre forwards are better than him in world football right now? I'm not sure. I mean,
Lewandowski probably.
Yeah, Lewandowski, maybe Kane. I don't know.
Haaland is, isn't he?
Haaland, yeah. But there aren't many. I mean, I just thought he's been brilliant, hasn't he?
Yeah, and he was curiously unable to have a huge impact against Real Madrid. He's done Real Madrid a massive favour in this Champions League. Actually, he missed the first game against Inter. Wasn't able to help Inter win the second game, not least because Arturo Vidal was got himself sent off and was back in Arturo Vidal's liability mode. And now, of course, has scored the goals, which gives Real Madrid a chance.
Natasha?
I was going to say, this is like, I have this big thing about footballers and sports people in general being human beings. I think Lukaku, even being in your top 10, shows how a happy player makes a happy player on the pitch. I mean, a happy person makes a happy player on the pitch. Because when he was at Man United, you wouldn't have been thinking about him even in your top 30. Now he's left there. He's happy. He's living life. He's got a bit of melanin, you know, extra sun on his skin, bit of vitamin D. And look at him now. We're all talking about him being in the top 10 of the world.
Yeah. I suppose, you know, players can improve as well, but yeah, it's a marked change in that footballer, isn't it?
He hasn't improved. He hasn't improved. He's just happy.
Yeah, I think this is one of the other things that we sometimes forget, and it, at the risk of stating the bleeding obvious, right? The worst footballer you've seen play in the third division is bloody brilliant. And I think we sometimes don't always appreciate that. That, you know, we very easily dismiss players. We very easily dismiss and say players aren't good enough. By the way, the people who most rapidly dismiss players and most sort of brutally dismiss players are players themselves. Have you ever heard a footballer talking about another footballer he doesn't think is good? My God. But this is it. Yeah, there's context is everything. The mechanics of the team, how happy a player feels, the whole environment around him. And Lukaku is really very good indeed.
We should go to Atleti Bayern 1-1. Bayern rested a few players, and Atleti really should have won this game, Sid, which would have been useful for them, wouldn't it?
Well, it really would, and it reached the point that the win would have been really, really important in a way. Well, no, not in a way. Mathematics tell you this, or is it arithmetic? I'm never really sure what the difference between the two things are. Every now and again, when I say maths, people say that's not maths, that's arithmetic. I say whatever it is, I can't do it. Atletico Madrid, really a draw of defeat makes no real difference to them because they've now got to go into the final game away and win it. They should have won this game against what was largely a Bayern Munich B team, but actually a pretty impressive Bayern Munich B team, given how young this team was, given the number of absences, and they had two 17-year-olds in the side last night, one of whom is English, an England international, and so you under 21 level. A kid who I must confess I didn't know hardly anything at all about, a guy called Jamal Musiala, who was one of two players who had joined Bayern Munich from Chelsea, and he played in the middle of midfield, and he looks like a really nice footballer. Very slim, very slight. His decision making's really good. His touches is lovely. He did a couple of really, really nice things. And it was kind of quite exciting because you have this situation in which Bayern Munich don't win for the first time in 15 Champions League games, and it should be a disappointment for them. But actually, by the end of the game, everyone's delighted. Although, as you say, from Atletico's point of view, Atleti really should have won this.
Yeah, they need a point at Salzburg next week to qualify after RB Salzburg won 3-1 at Lokomotiv Moscow. Can we talk about the new Champions League plan, everybody? UEFA are going to hold talks this week on a proposed a new Champions League from 2024, the Swiss system, often used in chess and other sports. 32 or 36 clubs in a single division. They wouldn't all play each other, but they'd play 10 games, five home and away, based on seeding. The points from then go into a single league table where you pick the top 16 for knockouts. The ones below go into the Europa League just to, you know, throw it on that competition. And it would mean four more matches, but it might make the group stages more interesting. Barry, as someone who hates the group stages, does this seem more interesting or less interesting?
I quite like it, actually. I don't think it can be worse than the current system. Now, I haven't given it a huge amount of thought to sort of come up with possible flaws, but on the face of it, I think it's quite an interesting plan. So, yeah, I did see, I think Miguel was stridently against it, Miguel Delaney.
Well, that's us in favour then.
but yeah, I was expecting to think it would be terrible, but I actually think it looks all right. I don't hate the group stages. I just find them quite dull. So this could also be quite dull, but at least it's a different kind of dull. One thing's for sure, Jurgen Klopp will not like it because it means Liverpool will have to play more games.
John, what do you reckon?
Yeah, I was going to say, it's good news for Des Kelly's BT Sport if they still hold the rights. This idea that it will be good because teams play bigger teams, there is more chance for teams to play bigger teams. So Manchester United, Barcelona or Liverpool, Real Madrid might be played more often. I'm not sure that that is the best thing in the world, because when those games have been pulled out of the hat in the Champions League or European Cup, as it used to be, those games felt special. So just because we've got this new Swiss system, what you don't want, I think, is for games like Liverpool, Real Madrid, Manchester United, Barcelona, you name any other great fixtures, to become habitual, where you just think, oh, well, it's only Barcelona next week. The European Club Association, it is, isn't it, the power brokers in this, they've been obsessed with the fact that UEFA got rid of the two group stages, what would it be, 16 years ago or so, because they like the extra revenue from those games. They didn't really seem to mind that those games often didn't really mean anything, particularly that first group stage. So this seems like a compromise situation. One of the things is, though, the report in the Times from Martin Ziegler, it explained it and it seemed sort of simple, but the simplicity of working out the table in a group seems to have gone really with this system. It's you know, a group of four, you know where you are, you know what you've got to win, that's fine. But this sort of 20 teams or 32 teams or whatever it's going to be, it sounds quite complicated and it's a compromise. And as always, it's about the money.
Sid, can we talk about La Liga how are Barcelona doing? I mean, that Messi's tribute to Maradona was lovely, and sports photography can be amazing. And that shot of Messi with the 10 perfectly aligned, part Barca, part Newell's Old Boys, was beautiful, wasn't it?
Yeah, kind of a fading in and fading out, wasn't it? It was almost like a transition moment from Maradona into Messi, as if the two of them are at one. And I must admit, and this is showing my age, and I'm not enough of a Doctor Who geek to be able to explain it or know if it has a phrase. But as soon as I saw this, I was thinking, this is when, and this is how old I am, this is when Tom, what's his face? The one with the scarf. What's his name again?
Tom Baker.
Well, this is when Tom Baker becomes, what's his face? Davison. Peter Davison. It's like sort of fades.
Regeneration.
Regeneration is a word I'm looking for, a kind of reincarnation. And I knew that there would be some Doctor Who people. This is why I didn't write this, because I thought I'm going to get it wrong and I'm going to get slaughtered by Doctor Who fans. That photo was perfect. It's amazing how well aligned the two number 10s were, and it was a really, really nice way of doing it. And I think will become probably the iconic image of all of the tributes to Maradona. Barcelona had a really good week last week. They finally resolved an agreement with the players to make 122 million euros worth of pay cuts. They managed to win at the weekend and play very well. Messi scored a brilliant goal from open play. He's not been scored. I think it was only his second from open play this season. And so things look slightly better. But we're still in a position, genuinely, where people in Spain are now starting to think, Is it possible that this year that Madrid or Barcelona don't finish in a Champions League place?
Robert says, question for Sid, is former Real Sociedad manager David Moyes getting attention in Spain for the magic he's doing with West Ham United? They're probably concentrating more on what Real Sociedad are doing themselves.
I mean, Real Sociedad playing lovely, lovely football. They only drew at the weekend. This was, I drove up to San Sebastian on Sunday to see them play. They were playing against Villarreal, first against third, and it finished as a 1-1 draw. Had Real Sociedad won, it would have been 7 wins in a row, which have been their best run in their entire history. They're a really, really nice team. Loads of young players coming through. They play really good football. David Silva was missing the weekend, but he's been brilliant. And then it occurred to me that it would be great, wouldn't it, if Real Sociedad won the league. They have a former Manchester City, Manchester United, Newcastle United and Arsenal player in their team. And it feels like a joke, although I haven't been able to make it work yet, which is obviously true of most of my jokes. You know, a former Man United, City, Arsenal and Newcastle player walk into a bar. The barman says, well, you have a title, or something like that. There you go. I'm still working on it.
God, it really does need work. Before we let you go, Sid, get your thoughts and everyone else's on Brexit's impact on the Premier League. The FA has announced a radical post-Brexit shake-up. That'll mean Premier League and EFL clubs cannot sign foreign players until they're 18. All transfers from the European Union nations set to be subject to work permits that will be allocated using a points-based system. Ed Aaron's writing, it could have seismic effects on the recent dominance of English clubs over European rivals. Any sort of result of Brexit, I instantly think, must be a complete disaster because of what an absolute bag of shite Brexit is. But I don't intrinsically have a problem with young...
We're taking back control.
Yeah. I mean, look, by the way, when you said earlier about the new Champions League and you said the Swiss system, I thought, oh, this sounds like another one of these things they've made up to fix Brexit. Don't worry, we'll use the Swiss system. And of course, unlike most of the plans to fix Brexit, it seems unnecessarily complex to me when everything worked reasonably well before and there was no need to break from it. But hey, that's by the way. I was also thinking about this Brexit impact last night, watching Musiala play for Bayern Munich, by the way. Because, of course, obviously I'm maybe sensitive to this, being an Englishman who lives in Spain. But all the focus has always been on closing Britain's door, on giving... It's to look at it from a football point of view, giving an opportunity to young British players, this will benefit the England national team. And I think we so rarely seem to look at it the other way around, which is you're closing the doors of 27 countries to English people, and in a footballing case, to English players. So watching Musiala play last night, I thought, you know, what impact would this have on players like him, who's an England under 21 international now, who at the age of 16 goes to Bayern Munich? Well, presumably this will work the other way as well. To him, Jadon Sancho, who's the other one I was thinking of that had done this? Bellingham's another example. Yunus Musa at Valencia. And so I thought that this is kind of the other side of this. Like you, I'm not intrinsically against the idea of trying to protect young players, and maybe not allowing them to move before the age of 18. Although obviously that's 18 is a labour market age, whereas of course the football labour market is younger than that, as we've seen with the fact that these kids at 16, 17, 18 are already first team players. One thing that is for sure, just to link it back to what you said from Ed Aarons' piece about the impact it may have on Premier League dominance of particularly of the young, talented player market, there is no doubt that clubs around Europe and obviously Spain is the market that I know best. We're very pleased about this. Spanish clubs have long felt that English clubs had an advantage and could steal their best players at 16 in that hiatus between 16 and 18. 16 when they could have professional contracts in England. They're not allowed to till they're 18 here. There was almost like a 2-year window of opportunity for British clubs to go and take their best players. It happened, obviously, most famously, perhaps, with Cesc Fabregas years ago. And so, yeah, some people in the rest of Europe are delighted about this.
Barry, you're waving your passport. Do you have it on you at all times, just in case you have to leave the country? Is that...
No, he's just doing it to pose, aren't you? Because look, I can travel, you can't.
It's in a drawer of the desk I'm sitting at. But yeah, this could be huge for the League of Ireland. They could take over Europe now.
This could be like all those tech companies moving into Dublin. The same thing could happen just with football clubs.
I was hearing actually that this doesn't apply to Irish talent, that English clubs can still sign Irish players at 16 because Britain and Ireland still have a reciprocal arrangement going back several years. So an Irish friend of mine said to me, that's probably bad news for British clubs, but I'll
I think Wes Houlihan's over 16, over 18, I think.
Yeah, just about.
Well, just theoretically riffing off the top of my head here, would it be conceivable, say, for, I don't know, Longford Town or Shamrock Rovers in the League of Ireland to come to some arrangement with Manchester City so that Longford Town sign the next Messi as a 14-year-old from Real Betis and then sell him on to Manchester City? Would that be allowed?
My theory would be if you've thought of it, Barry, someone there will have thought of it. That's my guess.
Do you know what I think is going to happen? I think football clubs technically have some of the best lawyers in the world. We will see a lot of parents of talented footballers getting jobs in the region of the club, therefore getting, you know, being able to move here, and then their children will sign for the clubs. But I think it's brilliant that all these football fans who are like, lads, Bants, rare, who voted for Brexit are now going to be moaning in a few years when they can't sign the most prestigious foreign talent. I think it serves, it's the turkeys voting for Christmas, isn't it? It serves you all right.
Well, I mean, the argument, the converse argument will be this is good for young English players. And I don't know what the answer to that. Intrinsically, I don't have a problem with young people not being sort of shipped to other countries when they're 15, 14, 12, 16, because young people should be able to be kids, because you, for every Lionel Messi, there are so many that it doesn't work out. And then they sort of lose their childhood and they don't have the football career. And so it, like, my first thought about this was, I want to hate this all because I hate Brexit, but there might be a tiny... Well, it only works if it's global, right, I guess, anyway.
Well, yeah, one thing is that foreign talent will be able to come into the country, but it does seem to be that it's going to be assessed on a points system. Now, we've heard a lot about the points system over the last 5 years or so of this Brexit, well, what do we call it, shitstorm. So it's going to be interesting how players are assessed on this point system. And as Natasha alluded to, you might need, certain clubs might have to lawyer up in the assessment of how players are assessed by this point system. As you said, Max, it all makes it very complicated. And it's all just going to be a bloody mess again. So thanks for that. Thank you, Brexit.
Sid, your hand's up.
Yeah, that's Zoom for you. I mean, in a way, just to say that this kind of process is already happening. There are clubs that are buying clubs in other countries, and this has happened. There are Spanish clubs, for example, that have investors from outside, basically as a way of bringing players in, giving them opportunities at a level lower than the one that they would come to in the Premier League, for example, and then bringing them to the UK, at which point, I mean, quite often we're talking about players from outside the EU, particularly African players, at which point you'd be able to get them a passport and then they would be eligible. Now, of course, that process will change, but some of the basic mechanics of that can be maintained. You can use foreign clubs to do exactly what Barry was suggesting. And then on a kind of a broader scale, yeah, you've got City, for example, own Girona. And that obviously is a place where players can play and get opportunities and then come in. That's a slightly different set of reasons, but the mechanics can be broadly similar.
Right, that'll do for part two. Sid, thanks for coming on. Chat to you again soon.
Pleasure. Cheerio.
We'll be back in 1 second. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's start this part talking about the Anton Ferdinand documentary, Football, Racism and Me. The impact of that incident with John Terry in 2011 on his football, on his life, on his family. I found it incredibly moving. And I found him sort of compellingly open and sensitive. And this whole idea that, you know, the victim in all this gets completely victimized and the fans boo him every time he went to a stadium because John Terry had lost the England captaincy, him getting sent bullets in the post, like the sort of social media attacks on him and his family. I know, Natasha, you were at the trial, the criminal trial for this case. I wonder, A, what that was like, and B, what you made of this documentary.
I think for me, it was very early in my career. And as a black female, I found it it very not eye-opening or surprising, but it was something that was very personal to me at that time, just racism in general and racism in football. In regards to the documentary, I know a lot of the people that worked on it. I spoke to them prior to the completion of it. The thing that I've tweeted about and that hits me most is the fact that Anton, the victim, and I hate to call him that because he did nothing wrong, has been the person that has been most quiet about this situation since it occurred. I think that is something that is a problem. I don't want to be political, but in wider society and in football in general. There was, being at the trial, I mean, I actually wrote a piece for The Guardian at the time, and to see Chelsea fans there popping bottles of champagne when John Terry was found not guilty was it. I don't even know how to describe it, but it felt dirty, I suppose, would be a good way of explaining it. To see Anton and Rio's mum and dad sitting in a courtroom every day, listening to the words that were directed at one of their children, for them to have to read in the paper, for them to be confronted every time they left the courtroom with cameras and journalists. And I'm part of the media, but I think it just shows the toxicity of and the lack of understanding, the lack of empathy for not just footballers in general, not just racism in general, but both together. I was lucky enough to watch it before it came out, and I'll be honest, I got very emotional because it is a subject that is very close to my heart. I'm all for equality and diversity, and I think for Anton to come out at this point, the only positive of that is the fact that he's chosen to speak about it now. It's not a case of someone else putting words into his mouth. It's his words, his feelings, his thoughts. But we only have to go on social media to see that really and truly 8 years later, nothing much has changed. Hopefully the conversation is now being amplified and people are being more honest. But when I see people saying that, oh, well, journalists commenting on it now have learned something. I'm sorry, if it took you 8 years to learn that something was unacceptable and racist, then I have no interest in having a conversation with you because you should have known that 8 years ago.
I found some of the most compelling parts of it. Anton Ferdinand, maybe Rio, his cousin who he works with, Max, and then Neil Warnock and other people, they were genuinely filming them, thinking about how they acted at the time, choosing to say something or not say something, and really wrestling with almost an impossible conundrum of what to do. Like, what do you do? This is, it's sort of nothing to do with you, but it's everything to do with you. You know, you didn't bring this upon yourself, and really trying to work out what the best thing to do was. And Anton sort of feeling like he let people down by not speaking out. But equally, speaking out wouldn't have been, well, I don't know, it wouldn't have been easy for him, and it wouldn't have made it any easier, I don't think.
I think there's a really sad part of situations like that where, you know, it's his response. It becomes his responsibility to discuss it, to bring up the conversation, rather than the responsibility of those who don't understand it, who haven't experienced it. You see a lot of people telling him, "Oh, get over it. It's been 8 years," or "it, you know, it wasn't that bad." But how dare you tell someone how they should feel, how they should react to a situation that you've never experienced? I'm not Anton. I know I got abuse for writing about it. That is probably 1% of the abuse that him, his, and Rio, his family got. I think we need to stop trying to victim shame. That's a general thing. And trying to police how people react to situations that hurt and cause them pain. I think the documentary, it could have gone on for a few hours. There was a lot of people spoken to and a lot of honesty. But I mean, really and truly, 8 years later, has anything changed? If this situation happened in 2020, 2021, I don't think anything would be different. And I think that's the thing that really, really sits with me.
John?
like you, Max, and obviously like Natasha, I was very moved by the documentary. Anton Ferdinand clearly is, how do I put this? He would appear to be a much more sensitive character than maybe the public image that we see of his brother. Let's put it that way. And my memory of this, you know, at the time I was editing a website, and it was one of those difficult stories to deal with, for various reasons around legal issues, and because it was a case that did go to court, of course. And the thing, looking back on it from you know, the reporting point of view, Natasha makes a good point that a lot of people talking about it now perhaps didn't write about it at the time or didn't attend the court case themselves, when maybe those that did should have the stronger voice on this. The thing is, I'm thinking about John Terry himself and the knots that the FA got themselves into over this. Fabio Capello quit his job as England manager because the FA took away the England captaincy from John Terry. Now, 8-9 years on, that almost defies belief that that was allowed to be seen as a valid reason for his departure. What you also forget, or what I had forgotten, is that for the Euros that followed it in Euro 2012, it was Rio Ferdinand rather than John Terry who was left out of the squad by Roy Hodgson for because they were worried about the, I suppose, the esprit de corps within the camp. That, so many years on, still sends a rather worrying message about how matters were treated back then. But as Natasha said, you know, we can't look on it and say, oh, things were different back then, because I look at the case of Jonathan Lecco and Kiko Kasia quite recently, an incident which was not dissimilar. And the thing that stands out about that case is Jonathan Lecco saying that how he felt that he wasn't given any support when he was the victim of racial abuse by another player. So you can, as some people have done, is try and look on the Anton Ferdinand documentary as some sort of timepiece, but it isn't. It's contemporaneous.
Barry?
Well, the whole thing was quite fascinating, but Anton Ferdinand's surprise when he heard what was, I think, a 4-minute extract of a longer interview when John Terry was being interviewed by someone from the FA to give his version of events, and that seemed like a friendly chat between two people, almost like they were having a drink together or something. Whereas Anton, we didn't hear his interview, but he said, and we've no reason to disbelieve him, that his was more like a grilling or an interrogation. That's why he was made feel the victim. And I think John Terry's silence was quite telling, because Anton, for anyone who hasn't seen it, wrote him an email, invited him to participate in this documentary, and Terry received the email and read it, but didn't dignify it with a response. And his people, his representatives, said he wanted to sort of leave it behind him. But I think it would have benefited hugely from John Terry's input. It might even have helped rehabilitate John Terry's image. But the fact of the matter is that his explanation for what happened back then was so utterly implausible that it possibly he just felt embarrassed and didn't want to have to go through that again.
What I don't know what you think, Natasha, what, you know, John Terry should do now.
I think, and this is something that is not just about racist abuse, I think a lot of people in the public eye need to be more aware of the fact that their supporters, their fans, maybe defend them in a way that is unhealthy, that is aggressive, that is abusive. I feel, for me personally, it would not change my view of John Terry as a person, having been in the court case, having listened to everything. But I do think that him engaging with Anton even if he continues to deny it was meant in a derogatory manner, I do think him engaging with Anton and the documentary would have saved Anton a lot of the abuse that he continues to receive. I'm not expecting John Terry to come out and say, yeah, I said this. Yeah, I'm this person. But him maybe acknowledging the fact of the wider complications of that situation would have maybe diverted the conversation to more support for Anton as opposed to abuse. I think what a lot of people don't understand is Anton didn't go to the police. Anton didn't report this. Someone independently outside of football saw it, like we all saw the video, and reported it. He was playing his game. He was doing his job. He was playing his game, and he didn't know what had gone on until he went upstairs and saw his wife and his family. And I think what the biggest issue I have is that Terry is still the conversation. Anton is not the conversation. Anton is the one that experienced this. Anton is the one whose career, not just him, but Rio's career was affected by this. Their parents' lives were affected by this. But yet you read articles and the first name you see is John Terry. The first comment you see is John Terry. The first opinion or defence you see is about John Terry. It's not about John Terry. It's about Anton for me, Anton Ferdinand, and it's about football. And I think while football continues to pretend this isn't an issue, we're going to be in denial. We need to wake up. And that's all of us. That's not just black, white, male, female. We all need to wake up and stop pretending this isn't a problem. Because until we acknowledge the fact that it is still a problem, we will never be able to start to solve the problem.
A correction from the last pod we did on the Edison Cavani case. I'd said he'd used exactly the same word as Luis Suarez. In the Patrice Evra case, that isn't quite correct. Cavani has subsequently apologised. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer says players from different cultures should receive education on racial issues. Solskjaer said he's deeply sorry for the mistake he's made. There was no malicious intent at all. He'll cooperate with the FA. Briefly to go through Monday night football, if you can remember that far back, Fulham won at Leicester in the 5:30 kickoff, really going against the grain by playing well during a Monday afternoon 5:30 game, which is not really acceptable. Tom says, now that Fulham have won two in letters, like the Vidi Printer games, does the pod think we can prove Richard Keys wrong and finish above 22nd? Richard Keys did his league table and had them finishing 22nd out of 20. I thought they played brilliantly in this game. John, if you want to give us a pithy 15-second review of this.
Well, yeah, I mean, Scott Parker gave one of his now signatory interviews in which he described piece by piece how hard his team worked to win the game. And I thought Fulham, particularly in the first half, were very, very good. If you would say anything about that game from a point of view, Scott Parker completely out-tacticked Brendan Rodgers, who didn't look happy at all, and rightly so.
I was so worried that Fulham wouldn't hold on just because of how sad Scott Parker would have been. He would have been sadder than Tarek Lamptey when Lamptey was sent off. I just wouldn't have been able to cope with someone putting another Scott Parker monologue over the streets. It would have.
Oh, they did.
There is a new one. There's a new one anyway.
Did they?
Yeah. I feel for Scott Parker, actually, because he must be really self-conscious now that... safe in the knowledge that every time he does an interview, someone's going to put the streets over it. But it was a brilliant win for them. Textbook counter-attacking display. I thought people were writing them off a bit too early. We do need to remember they had practically no pre-season at all. I'm not saying they're going to stay up, but I certainly give them a fighting chance. And hats off to them, although they've got Man City next, which is a bit of a kick in the bollocks when you look at the fixture list.
West Ham beat Villa 2-1. We don't need to talk about VAR and offside today. We've done it before. Just go back and listen to an old pod, preferably one without an echo, in quality audio, and you can hear what we all think. On the subject of VAR, Kevin says, I'm thinking of getting Barney Ronay's Man United penalty monologue made into a kind of live, life, love, wall... quote thing. Can the pod recommend any good fonts that would set it off in a downstairs loo type setting? Thank you, Kevin.
You gotta go Comic Sans.
Comic Sans. Mike says, hi, Max. Since you've retracted your When Did Reading Get Good segment, they've now won again. Please, can you never say anything nice about them again? Brackets, commenting on how everyone is indifferent to us is fine. Lovely stuff. Thanks. I fear by reading this out, I have mentioned that you won. So this is a very difficult situation I've put myself in. We should congratulate Nivaldo, who won the 80s footballers aging badly Twitter FA Cup. He's 29. He looks about 85. It's miraculous. And there have been some really good, fun things on Twitter, like the guy who did this, you know, supermarkets as football kits. But this one I really loved. And, you know, thank you to Winston, I think, is the guy who did it, and Henning Vane, who got involved. And it provided me with a lot of joy. And I know you enjoyed it as well, Baz, didn't you?
Yeah, it was fantastic. Who was it who beat in the final again, the Scottish goalkeeper?
Ernie McGarr, was it?
I thought Ernie, I felt for Ernie. I voted for Ernie. But yeah, just the...
Nivaldo's in his 20s.
What?
He's in his 20s, Nivaldo. Well, I got this great message from Kevin. I said, I've supported Nivaldo since I was a boy. And Kevin said, I'm not buying this, you glory hunter. Where were you when he was shit? Anyway, that'll do for today. We've banged on for long enough. Thank you so much for your time, John.
Cheers, Max.
Thank you, Natasha.
See you later, guys.
Thanks, Barry.
You're welcome.
We're back tomorrow. Tomorrow? God, they come round quickly, don't they? Yes, we're back tomorrow.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.